Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. Characterizing it as a war for the free world is something that our guest for this very special edition of Secure Freedom Radio has done arguably as well, if not considerably better, than just about anybody else. He is Soren Kern. These days, he is a senior fellow at the highly regarded Gatestone Institute. He also serves as a senior analyst on European politics at the Madrid-based Strategic Studies Group. He has written extensively for these and other publications. He's also in the past been a contributing analyst for Jane's Information Group and a personal favorite of mine because it suggests he's come a very long way. Indeed, is formerly the managing editor of Arms Control Today. Soren Kern, I can't tell you how pleased I am to have you back and to have a full hour to talk with you. So thank you so much for taking the time.
Oh, thank you so much to you for inviting me. Thanks. My pleasure.
Well, let's begin with the latest evidence of what's happening in this war for the free world in an unlikely place. It would seem Sweden. Yesterday, there was another attack using a vehicle. The perpetrator seems to be at large at the moment. Talk a little bit about what's happening in Sweden, perhaps using this attack as a prism through which to explore it, Soren.
Yeah, well, what we're seeing is that these attacks using trucks as weapons is becoming more frequent in Europe. We've seen it in France. We've seen it in Germany. We've seen it in the UK recently, and now in Sweden. And I'm afraid that this is going to be a permanent scene in European cities. It's becoming increasingly unsafe, and it's essentially due to jihadists who effectively have come into the country as migrants on a mass scale. European governments really don't know who they've allowed into the country, and many of these people hate their host society. Evidently, they are using these measures that are very, very difficult for European security authorities to counter. You can, to some certain extent, probably track, if someone is trying to buy explosives or if someone is trying to buy weapons. About these sort of things where somebody just jumps into a truck, hijacks it, and runs over people, this is something that's completely outside of the control of European authorities. And I'm afraid this is going to be repeating itself frequently.
Yeah. Soren, there are other phenomena that are also troubling in places like Sweden. Perhaps you might talk a little bit about rape, which seems to be skyrocketing at the hands of these immigrants particularly. What's the latest on that?
Yeah, this is a European-wide phenomenon. This really is quite shocking. One of my colleagues at the Gatestone Institute, who is herself from Sweden, Ingrid Carlquist, has written extensively about the rape problem and in Sweden. She calls it the rape capital of Europe, of Western Europe. We see the same thing playing itself out in Norway and other Scandinavian countries, and now particularly in Germany. And I think this is just a aspect of Islamic culture. There is no respect for Western women. Many of these migrants have no respect for their host countries, for their host societies. They see non-Muslim women as, looking at it from the context of Islamic conquest. They see Western women as war booty, and they're allowed to do with them what they want. And many of these women who become impregnated, these children are expected to grow up as Muslims. So there's just another, there are many dimensions of looking at this problem.
What you've of course touched on is a theme here, and that is that these immigrants are primarily from Muslim countries, and many of them, it appears, are imbued with these, well, I think of them as Sharia supremacist notions, whether it's women as war booty or the obligation to engage in violence, terrifying violence at that, to advance their causes. But as you look at this, in, again, not just the context of Sweden, Soren Kern, but as an increasingly unmistakable pattern across the continent, does this approach, in your judgment, the point where civil society is beginning to break down at the hands of these Sharia supremacists?
Yes, I totally agree with that assessment. I think that the civil society breakdown is happening on several different levels. And one of them essentially is that people, particularly women, are increasingly afraid to go out alone. And we're not talking about just at night or, you know, in the evenings, but we're talking about in many parts of Germany where women will not go outside, or will not go outside if they're not accompanied by someone else. So we see already a certain, you know, move towards many similarities with Islamic countries, because you go to an Islamic country, many times you won't see any women on the streets. You'll just see males on the streets. And so I think the other real problem that I see here is that the governments in all European countries are in absolute denial about this problem. And as you know, in European countries, people don't have the same freedom of speech, you know, First Amendment rights. So the European governments, particularly in Germany now, is trying very hard to make it a crime to talk about this. And there's been a lot of self-censorship in the press. If it's a migrant that's responsible for the rape, you cannot identify the country or the your origin of that. They're trying to basically pretend that this is not a problem. Now, the Gatestone Institute, we have really documented this quite, you know, extensively, particularly in the German context. And what we've done is essentially go through police reports at the local level. I mean, I'm talking about the municipal level, because you don't see this, you know, in European papers. And when you see month by month all of the rapes, and these migrants, you know, they're never referred to as migrants, but they're referred to as southerners or sort of politically correct euphemisms, you can really piece together a shocking, shocking picture of rape of women that really extend from small children, rapes of four-year-old girls, all the way to elderly women age 80 and above. It's really a shocking, shocking phenomenon that's taking place.
And apparently, correct me if I'm wrong, Soren, that that young boys are being afflicted as well. This is not confined to females in the society, whatever their age may be. Is that correct?
That is correct. You know, European countries, particularly Germany and the northern European countries, have a very big culture of public swimming pools, going to the baths. And this is where a lot of these migrants are taking advantage of small children, being boys or girls. It's really, you know, it's both sexes that are being affected by this. Yes.
There's a practice that I understand is perhaps at work in part, at least for the immigrants from Muslim societies in the Middle East, that's called taharush. I don't know if you're familiar with that term, but it apparently is a time-honored practice of sort of gangs of young men molesting women that they can get their hands on. And is this something you have picked up as well? And is it now, well, you've suggested it's a sufficiently widespread problem in one form or another, whether it's the gangs or whether it's individuals, that women are modifying their behavior more or less in conformity with kind of Sharia traditions.
Yeah, the term taharush gamia is an Arabic term, and it translates roughly to rape game. And this is something that apparently is very common in northern Africa, particularly Egypt and Morocco and Algeria, Tunisia. And we're seeing this occurring much more frequently in Germany. We saw the New Year's Eve celebrations in 2015, where thousands of women were essentially assaulted by large, large groups of young migrants. Now, we've been following that at Gatestone quite extensively as well, and we see that repeating itself on a smaller scale very, very frequently. Recently in a shopping center in Kiel, the city north of Hamburg in Germany, groups of migrants, you know, they hang out at shopping centers because there's free internet Wi-Fi signals. So they hang out there, and then they assault women who are shopping, who are eating at restaurants. We see this over and over and over again.
Soren Kern is our guest from the Gatestone Institute. We'll be right back with much more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. Our guest for this full hour of a very special and really required listening edition of Secure Freedom Radio is Soren Kern. He's one of the most astute observers and chroniclers of what's happening in the face of jihadism across Europe these days, but also what all of these trends and dynamics and threats mean for us in the United States as well. Soren, thank you again. We're visiting about the problems in Europe at the moment. I'd like to just ask you to sort of give us a flavor, as you see it, based on a lot of study, of what's animating this kind of conduct. What would cause people who are getting safe haven in Western societies that are free and enormously generous to behave in these really barbaric fashions?
Yeah, it's very difficult to pin it down. I think that there are real problems with assimilation. This is really the crux of the matter, that many of these migrants are either not assimilatable or they refuse to assimilate to the host countries. And I think you can really track that back down to Sharia law and sort of the socio-political context in which many of these people grew up in their home countries. Now, I think that if you look at Sharia law, it is completely and totally against assimilation. I mean, the Sharia teaches that there should be no assimilation of Muslims to non-Muslim cultures. It teaches exactly the reverse. The whole idea of Sharia is essentially to bring the non-Muslim world into conformity with Muslim standards and Muslim ideals. And so I think that this really is part of what's driving this.
Now, what we're hearing too, though, and I just want to tease this out with you, to some extent we're told that that's because these Western societies are simply not accommodating. They're not inviting or enabling assimilation. And some would have us believe that these kinds of trends are not going to be a problem for the United States because we do invite and facilitate in the great melting pot tradition assimilation. Soren, is it the fault of Western societies that Muslims are not assimilating more in at least Europe?
Well, I think you can lay part of the blame on Western societies. Many of these European countries have invited these people in. And I think that in European countries, the concept of immigration is very different from what it is in the United States. European countries are not melting pots by any sense of the imagination. And what you have essentially in places like France is where you have large ghettos on the outskirts of Paris. You have an entire generation of young French Muslims who are completely disenfranchised from, you know, French society. If you have Muhammad or Ahmed as your name on a resume, it's very unlikely that you're ever going to be hired by a French company. So there's a lot of racism against these migrants that is built into European societies, and Europeans will deny it. They like to project themselves as the vanguard of multiculturalism, of tolerance. When you really look at the reality of the day-to-day, it is very difficult to be a migrant in a European country.
But yet you've spent a lot of time, I know, in Germany and monitoring what's happening there. As I understand it, Soren, one of the rationales for Angela Merkel to have essentially thrown open the doors of her country to unlimited migration from these Muslim nations of the Middle East, North Africa, Afghanistan, and elsewhere has been the need for an infusion of labor into their markets because the native population is declining dramatically. Is that at work in some countries in Europe and not others? And where it is at work, are they nonetheless still finding this problem of unassimilated, unassimilable, maybe Muslim Sharia supremacists?
Sure. I think it's different from country to country. I think particularly the demographic problem is very acute in Germany, and there has been a specific intent by the German government to bring in migrants to keep the social welfare system afloat. The German government recently, well, let's just say there was a leaked report by the German government which revealed that German authorities are counting on the inflow of 300,000 migrants a year for the next 20 years to keep the population stable. All of the European countries have similar problems, but this is really the first European country that I've seen where they're deliberately bringing in migrants who effectively are unassimilatable. And what I don't understand personally is that with so much unemployment in Italy and Greece and Spain, why German authorities don't make it easier for EU nationals to, you know, to come to Germany and to work, are bringing in people from a completely foreign culture, many people who are actually illiterate in their home countries, not to mention trying to learn a language as complicated as German. I think the German authorities have really not thought through the full consequences of their actions.
You know, you spoke about their preoccupation with keeping the population stable, but it really does seem as though they're overlooking the natty little problem that that population may be increasingly hostile to the government, the traditions, the freedoms, as well as the rest of the native population. So it does beg the question, what are they thinking, and why wouldn't they accept fellow Europeans who share many, if not all, of the same values and traditions? And all I can say, it comes back to something you touched on in the first segment, Soren, and I'd like to revisit it with you if I could. And that is this idea that it is now essentially impermissible to talk about these various problems, these phenomena, whether it's doctoring the statistics of what happened with these rapes, or whether it's talking more broadly about the nature of the agenda of so many of these people, namely their God-directed duty to impose Sharia.
Sure. I think that there is a complicity between the media and the governments, in particular the case in Germany. All of the mainstream media outlets, whether television, newspaper, radio, are heavily subsidized by the German state. And that there's an expectation that these periodicals or these media outlets toe the government line. I think there's also this idea that there has been so much invested in multiculturalism. This idea really started after the end of the Second World War. The idea was essentially in order to avoid a repeat of the Second World War, which is often blamed on nationalism, on German nationalism, on French nationalism. The idea with multiculturalism is bring in as many foreign people to make Germany less German and to make France less French. And so I think that there are a lot of people who have their whole careers invested in this idea of multicultural society. And for them now to admit that they've made a huge mistake, I think that is too much.
You know, one of the particularly stunning confirmations of what you were just saying, Soren, was Tony Blair, as Prime Minister of Britain, I think, actually acknowledged that the Labour Party in his country, of which he was the leader for many years, decided to punish the Conservatives by basically bringing in very large numbers of migrants who would not only vote for Labour, more likely than not, much as many of these folks vote for Democrats in this country, but who would be completely at odds with the Conservative Party and, for that matter, the traditions of Great Britain. And I wonder whether they have, in fact, actually owned up to the mistake in that country or in any of these others. We certainly don't see much evidence of it in what is being written, perhaps for some of the reasons you've mentioned, the collusion between those engaged in self-censorship. Soren, we have to pause for just a moment. When we come back, I want to talk more about various forms of jihad, some of which we've alluded to here, but to get a little bit more clear about what we are facing here in the United States as well. That and much more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are speaking with one of the most, well, thoughtful, I think, perspicacious is the 50-cent word for it, men I know in the business of trying to monitor and assess and raise an alarm about the jihadism that this country and indeed much of the free world is now facing. He is Soren Kern, a senior fellow with the Gatestone Institute. You can find its work at his, among others, terrific contributors at gatestone.org. Let me ask you to sort of put what we've been talking about to this point, Soren, into context. We've discussed the violence kind of jihad, the vehicular attacks, the rapes. We've talked a little bit about the phenomenon of these, well, the people who are perpetrating much of that in Western countries in Europe at the moment, particularly. How did they get there? And more to the point, what is the impetus in Sharia for them to migrate, or if you will, colonize non-Muslim lands?
Yeah, well, that really gets down to the heart of the matter. I think what we see here really is, in a broad brush, is a spiritual problem. You know, European societies have become hyper-secularized to the extent that Americans can't even imagine. And so it's really created a spiritual power vacuum, to my mind, that is being filled very rapidly by Islam. Now, I think that Islam really needs to be understood for what it is. The meaning of the word Islam is obviously it's submission. It's not peace, as President Obama and President Bush always wanted us to believe. Submission. Islam is submission to the will of Allah. And the will of Allah is in the Sharia. And the way that you bring, let me just step back, is that the whole idea of Islam breaks the world down into two categories of people, those who are Muslims and those who are not. And according to Islamic law, there will never be peace in the world until all of the non-Muslims are brought under the submission of the Muslims. That's the core essence of Islam, of submission. And so there are many different ways that, you know, that this is carried out, but jihad, there can be peaceful means of jihad and there can be violent means of jihad. Jihad is essentially holy war, the process of conquering the world for Islam.
So it's not about personal struggle, as we've been told, often by the same people who claim it's a religion of peace.
It's very clearly, if you read the Quran and if you read the Islamic base scriptures and doctrines, it's very clearly that the jihad is far more than just a personal struggle with sin or with whatever. It's very clearly a means to conquer the non-Muslim world. And so I think that what we have, there's a term in Islam called hijra, which is essentially migration, conquest through demographics. And I think this is really what we're seeing in Europe. We're seeing large-scale migration of Muslims who won't integrate because the Sharia prohibits them from integrating. And the Sharia essentially obliges all true Muslims to bring the non-Muslims into the Muslim fold. And so I see that European leaders, even European church leaders who have become so secularized and so de-Christianized and so far removed from, you know, the essence of the Bible, that they have lost the ability to think in spiritual terms and to understand the spiritual dimension of Islam. You know, Islam is a religious system, but it's also a political system that essentially is shrouded as a religious system. And I think, you know, Westerners have just lost the ability to think in those terms, to think in the terms that there is actually a political religious system like Islam that is fully, fully intent on world domination, because that's the whole essence of Islam.
Well, you know, this is why I focus, as we do my colleagues at the Center for Security Policy, on Sharia as a means of helping to differentiate between what most of us would think of as the qualities and you know, practice of a religion from what is fundamentally, as you've said, an expansionist, totalitarian, supremacist, brutally repressive doctrine, namely Sharia. And while I understand that, you know, the authorities of the faith say they are one and the same, and many Muslims, you know, practice both, it does seem to me that it's helpful, Soren, especially for Westerners who don't think of religion as having any of these, the latter qualities at all, to understand what's afoot here, and therefore what needs to be defended against. And I, as you were speaking, I just wanted to mention that, unfortunately, the migration is only one piece of sort of this demographic jihad. There's also high birth rates and also polygamy. Would you talk about how those are manifesting themselves in societies like those of Western Europe, for example?
Yeah, what happens essentially is that when there's large-scale migration into Western Europe from Muslim countries, many of these people begin to congregate in certain sections of the cities, ghettos, I guess you could call it. And so as they get larger and larger and larger, you see increasing demands for concessions to the Muslims. So what you see is in all European countries, you see increasing concessions by secular states to Sharia law, to accepting parts of Sharia law. And many of the Sharia courts, so to speak, in European countries adjudicate civil matters, divorces, inheritances. So what we have really is the emergence of a parallel justice system in many European countries where, you know, you have to understand that the Sharia is in essence completely incompatible with Western democracy, because the Sharia does not believe that Muslims and non-Muslims are equal. So it's just, there's no compatibility. But what is happening is what sometimes referred to as a creeping Sharia. There are little concessions here and there, allowing exceptions to polygamy is one of those. Now you have a situation in which polygamy is illegal in all European countries, but exceptions are made for the migrants. So you have one case, for example, in Germany, where one man from Syria has an extended family of 24 or 25 with his wives and children, and he's receiving 250,000 euros a year in subsistence from the state, from German taxpayers.
This is a suicide scenario.
There are believed to be more than 1,500 polygamous marriages just in Berlin alone. So, and you see this repeated in France and in the UK and other countries.
To some extent, as I understand it, they rationalize this, Soren Kern, by saying, well, as long as you've married them someplace else, you can bring them in. But the idea that all of these people can be put on the dole is a formula for bankrupting these host societies, inevitably, it seems to me, to say nothing of, you know, outpacing the population. We're already told, Soren, that Muhammad is the most popular name in the United Kingdom, and the trends are for these populations to surpass native populations in this century. It's really almost unbelievable, but chilling. Not because these individuals, as individuals, are Muslims or because of their pietistic practice, but because to the extent that they are embracing this supremacist doctrine, they must destroy the host societies. And this is an important message for us here in the United States as well. Very quickly, Soren, let me at least introduce the topic of zakat. What is that about, and how does that play into what you're seeing in Europe at the moment and elsewhere?
Well, zakat is a form of almsgiving, a form of charity. What you see in many European countries, presumably in the United States as well, is that many, you know, Muslim charities are set up under the guise of being humanitarian agencies or organizations, but whose primary mission really is to perpetuate and speed up the spread of Islam and Islamic values and Islamic norms in Western countries.
In other words, it's a way of providing material support for jihad of one kind or another. Soren, this is incredibly important. I want to turn in the next segment, which we have to turn to momentarily, to another kind of jihad, a stealthy form of jihad. And we'll get into that and what it might mean for you straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We're talking with Soren Kern of the Gatestone Institute about the threat posed by what I think of as Sharia supremacism to Western societies. He has been extraordinarily effective in describing symptoms of this phenomenon in Europe and is helping to shed light on what it might mean for us here in the United States as well. And Soren, I'd like to talk a little bit about, in addition to the violent jihad, in addition to the demographic jihad and its various forms, in addition to this zakat or material support for terrorism, and there's, of course, other purposes to which zakat is applied, but some of it is supposed to go to jihad. There's also what the brothers call civilization jihad. Talk a little bit about how that operates in a sort of stealthy way. Again, much in evidence in Europe, but also here.
Yeah, well, what we have essentially is large organizations like the Muslim Brotherhood who are promoting this idea of civilizational jihad. This essentially is hollowing out the essence of Western civilization and Islamizing it. I think if you look back to the early formation of the Muslim Brotherhood in the late 1920s, it was sort of a reaction to the demise of the Ottoman Empire. And, you know, Islamic countries have always been historically under one leader, one dominant leader, the caliph. And the last caliphate, Islamic Empire, ended really when Turkey allied itself with Germany in the First World War. And the victorious European powers essentially carved out the Middle East to the nation-state system that it is today. Essentially, the idea of the Muslim Brotherhood and the Islamic State is to undo the nation-state system, undo Israel and Syria and Palestine and Jordan and Saudi Arabia, and bring all of the, you know, all of the Islamic world back into, you know, one monolithic block. And from there, really to be able to be a pole, a geopolitical pole, as a way to expand Islam, you know, across other parts of the world. So the basic ideas behind the Muslim Brotherhood is essentially Muslim unity, and through that Muslim unity to really challenge Western society. And so there's a lot more behind the Muslim Brotherhood that people often don't want to talk about.
Yeah. And when you say unity, I would argue it's dominating the Muslim communities for the purpose of essentially turning them into forces to achieve the triumph of Sharia. And, you know, you spoke earlier, Soren, about these ghettos or enclaves. Some have called them no-go zones. Typically, it's my understanding, they fall under the sway of people like the Muslim Brothers who are seeking to, as I say, dominate those populations and bend them to their supremacist agenda. Would that be fair?
Yeah, it is. It's fair. You know, I think that one of the methods of the Muslim Brotherhood and other groups like this is what I call the mainstreaming of Islam in the West. The idea that Islam is just another religion like Judaism, Christianity, that it's, you know, Muslims worship the same God as the Jews and the Christians. And they try to basically present all of the positive sides of Islam while maintaining their ultimate goal of civilizational jihad. Now, these no-go zones that you referred to in European cities, European authorities are often reluctant to admit that they exist. But we've documented at the Gatestone quite extensively. We have these areas in major European cities that are essentially off limits to local political authorities. And, you know, particularly in the case of France, in some parts of Germany, I'm writing an article right now as we speak on no-go zones in Berlin, and it's quite shocking how parts of the capital, you know, that only 20 or 30 years ago were divided between East and West, are now being divided between Germany and Islam-dominated, you know, groups.
Yeah, it's chilling. No physical barrier exactly, but there is, as a practical matter, a place that is off limits to not just the average citizen of Berlin or Germany, but even the authorities dare not go into them. Soren, let me ask you about the Brotherhood's role in countries in terms of the notion that they are an alternative to the violent jihadists. When you hear people talk about moderate Islamists, or when you hear people talk about the Brotherhood having eschewed violence, does that actually track with your understanding and study of the matter?
Well, we saw the Muslim Brotherhood in action in Egypt, and they were anything but peaceful. And that is why they've been removed from power in Egypt. There's a lot of, you know, taqiyya, it's an Arabic term really for dissimulation, trying to make something out to be what it really isn't. And I think that a lot of these Muslim Brotherhood groups have gained a certain degree of respectability in European countries. They present themselves as legitimate interlocutors between Muslim communities and local governments. But again, the ultimate underlying goal of all of this is really civilizational, you know, conquest, as you just mentioned.
It's a pre-violent form of activity, not so much a non-violent one. It's setting the stage. And would you agree with me, Soren, that if you look at the prime function, it seems to me, of the Brotherhood in countries like the United States, this isn't just over there, this is here, folks, is building an infrastructure that enables the aggregation of unassimilated Muslims in such enclaves and ultimately dominating them and turning them into engines of, again, Sharia supremacism. So I'm looking at things like mosques and front groups and influence operations that have, in a number of cases, been associated with actual violent jihadists, but have also, it seems, been in the service of incubating folks who may well be such jihadists in the future.
Yeah, a lot of the Islamist ideology is essentially designed or conceptualized by the Muslim Brotherhood over the last, you know, 30, 40, 50, 60 years. And I think that the violent jihadists, the people in the Islamic State and the Caliphate, they all got their ideology from the Muslim Brotherhood. I mean, that's completely clear. And I think the issue that you raise with the mosques is also very important. You know, if a Jew or a Christian goes to a temple or a church, those are buildings of gathering for worship. But in a mosque, it's really a completely different idea. It's much more than a building, because in Islamic theology, once a territory is Muslim, it's always Muslim. And so these are political symbols, more than anything, of the, you know, the spread of Islam, and that Islam is in a particular neighborhood or in a particular city, and it's here to stay. And I think it's very significant that President Obama and the Turkish president did the groundbreaking of a large mega mosque in Maryland, right outside of the capital of the United States. You know, it's a symbol that Islam is part and parcel, and that it's not going away. What you see in European cities is the idea that minarets should be taller than steeples in church buildings, and that they're changing the skylines of European cities as a sign of dominance, that Islam is dominant, that it's on the rise, it's ascendant, and it's not going away.
We keep ignoring this reality, I think, at our extreme peril. I want to come back in our final segment with Soren Kern to the issue of, are people who don't get this now increasingly populating the Trump administration? And if so, how could that possibly be? given the seeming clarity of the president about the danger posed by what he called radical Islamic terrorism. Right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. I hope you haven't missed the previous segments of this conversation with Soren Kern. If you have, I strongly encourage you to go to our podcasts at securefreedom.org to make sure you don't miss a word of it, because we've been blessed to have with us a man who has thought deeply about and has, more to the point, carefully chronicled what I consider to be the existential threat to freedom of our time. My old boss, Ronald Reagan, used to talk about every generation having one, and ours, I think unmistakably, is the threat posed by Sharia supremacism. What is particularly troubling is that the president of the United States, Donald Trump, came to office with a degree of clarity about this point that was not only refreshing, but I think was compelling to large numbers of voters, so much so that I think it had actually a very material effect on his electoral prospects. In other words, he got it. Unfortunately, there's evidence, and some of it is very lucidly documented in Soren Kern's latest piece at the Gatestone Institute, and again, you can check it out at gatestoneinstitute.org, is under the headline, White House Officials Divided on Islam, ISIS, Israel, and Iran. Soren Kern, talk about this potentially tragic story that you've documented in your new piece.
Yeah, it is truly tragic to my mind. I think that President Trump was receiving very good advice from Steve Bannon on this issue of Islam. And Steve Bannon has long understood that Western civilization is in an existential crisis, existential conflict with Islam, and that Islam is on the ascendancy. And Bannon, I think, brought in people like Michael Flynn. General Flynn, for whatever ethical failings, he did understand the issue, the magnitude of, of radical Islam, and he was very determined to do something about it. Unfortunately, when President Trump, when Flynn resigned, President Trump decided to go with another national security advisor, General McMaster. Now, General McMaster and General Flynn have completely opposing viewpoints on the nature of Islam. You know, and so what you see with McMaster is that he does not see a link between terrorism and Islam. He does not see Islam as being, you know, he doesn't see Islam as in ideological terms. He does not see the danger of it. And the problem really is that he is the principal advisor to Donald Trump.
But let me ask you this. He's widely regarded as a very learned man. He's written a book about the political influence on military personnel that had in the past contributed to our defeat in a previous conflict, namely with the Vietnamese, North Vietnamese, Viet Cong, and so on. And yet he seems to be missing some of the very fundamental teachings of Sharia that you've spoken about so eloquently here today. Based on your reading of his writings and his comments that we have to date, what's going on there, Soren Kern?
Well, I think that there is no difference at all between McMaster's view of Islam and President Obama's view of Islam. I think that the resignation of General Flynn and the naming of McMaster as the National Security Advisor has dramatically shifted the administration's view on Islam and how to deal with it. And I think the Trump administration is really moving in the direction of essentially copying the Obama administration's view on Islam. Islam is a religion of peace, and that there's no link between Islam and terrorism. And I think there's this misguided idea with McMaster and with many others that if you just defeat the Islamic State, the caliphate in Iraq and Syria, that you can deal with the problem of radical Islam. The problem really extends much farther than that. I mean, the Islamic State is only 5 years old. Muslim Brotherhood has been on this mission for almost a century. And so many of these migrants, many of these people who are fighting on the battlefields of Syria and Iraq, at least 5,000 Europeans are there. They're going to go back to Europe if the Americans destroy the Islamic State. But not only that, there are going to be tens of thousands, potentially hundreds of thousands of Islamic State followers who've been radicalized on the battlefield who are not European or who have no links to Europe, but they're also going to be heading to Europe and by extension to the United States to fight the jihad, to take revenge on the Islamic State. And it's the ideology, it's the basis of all of this. And I think people like McMaster, by bringing in, let's say, I see a process that he's easing out of the White House all of the people who have Bannon's and Flynn's idea that the problem with radical Islam is far greater than just defeating the Islamic State. We see systematically that these people are being replaced with people who view Islam exactly the way President Obama did.
We've actually been told that McMaster has said something to the effect that he's having trouble filling the vacancies at the National Security Council because all of the good people are either Democrats or never Trumpers. In other words, people who rejected specifically, I think, or at least among other things, Donald Trump's characterization of the problem as one of radical Islamic terrorism, which, again, McMaster said apparently at his first staff meeting he rejected as a way of describing the problem. So this is not, unfortunately, confined to General McMaster. Soren Kern, in your piece at the Gatestone Institute about White House officials being divided, you actually go into the difficulties that have arisen as a result of both holdovers from the Obama administration and some who've been brought in by President Trump's own senior subordinates that are affecting departments besides the White House and the National Security Council. Very quickly, give us a flavor of that, if you would.
Sure. This extends to the Justice Department, extends to the Defense Department, to the State Department, to the National Economic Council. We have really is essentially a lot of holdovers from the Obama administration who are essentially implementing, you know, Trump's foreign policy. And those foreign policies are...
Or not implementing Trump's foreign policy, as the case may be.
There is really no Trump foreign policy formulated at this point, you know. So what we see essentially is a continuation of putting the pressure on Israel, putting the pressure on the onus on Prime Minister Netanyahu to make concessions for peace with the Palestinians. There's a move afoot to make sure that the Iran deal does not get abrogated or renegotiated in any way. These are all Obama loyalists.
Or even fully re-examined, I'm told. You know, there was a move afoot early on in the administration to have, I think it's 14 different secret codicils to that agreement, such as it was released, and that isn't happening either. So to the extent that the president actually had a policy, an agenda, if you will, that he sought the people's mandate to execute, just in the briefest of terms, Soren Kern, where does that stand now as a result of these personnel choices?
Yeah, I unfortunately see that as evaporating, that many of President Trump's promises on the campaign trail are not going to be fulfilled. And I see, you know, President Trump is really the last opportunity for the United States to deal with many of these issues. I mean, we're not just talking about Islam, but we're talking about the Iran question. We're talking about larger, you know, ideological issues. And I am afraid, you know, that President Trump is not going to, you know, to comply with his commitments on many of these things. And it's really a tragedy to my mind.
Well, it would be the realization of that existential threat if that were to happen. I pray you are not correct. I fear you may be. Soren Kern, on these, as on so many other issues, your vision, your clarity, your courage in describing them at a time when so many of us are self-censoring is incredibly important and deeply appreciated. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon, and that the rest of you will come back to us again on Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.